This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable. All right, everybody. This is the Hunting Gear Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Johnson. And today we are joined by guest, Mr. Aaron Berg. Aaron, how are we doing, dude?
Doing great. It's good to talk to you again.
Yeah, absolutely. For those of you who don't know, you were on the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast recently. You were on the Western Rookie podcast. Was that it?
Yep, both of those.
Yep, both of those recently. And I was like, hey, dude, I've taken up a lot of your time. Can I take up some more? And let's talk hunting gear and equipment. And the reason I want to talk hunting gear and equipment today is with you specifically, is because you have like a unique, you're not the average Joe when it comes to your access, how you approach hunting, because you're doing it. I don't know. Do a lot of people around you do it the way that you do it as far as your hunting strategy is concerned?
No. And I mean, that's why I do the things that I do, is just to try and get away from most of those people. Right. You know, a couple of my hunting buddies do it the same way. And we just bounce ideas off of each other, what's working, what's not, to try and dial in these access routes a little bit better. But, you know, anytime you deal with water or anything else, like, you're eliminating 95% of the people on that property just by accessing it a different way or getting back into these little wet areas that nobody else wants to deal with.
Yeah. And essentially you're making it harder.
Yeah. There's plenty of spots that I hunt where you can access it from a road. You can access it on a dryway, but it just makes more sense to access it, either being more quiet by accessing it by water or getting to a backside of something where all the pressure is pushing those deer towards you rather than you pushing them away from you like everybody else does.
Yeah. So all of that's going to be taken into consideration today. So the first thing that I'm going to say is, after this episode, go to the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast. I forget the title of it. Something about swamp, like hunting swamp bucks or something like that. And listen to that episode, because that will help this podcast also make a little bit more sense about how he hunts and the conditions that he's in. But essentially you hunt swamp in swamps in Wisconsin, and you use canoes and waders and water access into these spots. And you're basically backdooring these deer every hunt somewhere.
Yeah.
Does that make, okay. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I would say 90% of my hunting is done in swamps or difficult access pieces, as long as time allows it. You know, sometimes it is nice to have a 5 or 10 minute walk into your tree stand and you just squirrel up the tree and you're in and ready to go. But if I have the time, I'm going to do a tougher access.
Gotcha. Okay. So let's start from the truck. All right. You mentioned a canoe, right? What kind of canoe do you have? How long is it? Have you changed canoes, over your period of, you know, hunting like this, to go with a shorter canoe or a longer canoe? How did you make that decision?
Yeah. When I started doing this, I ended up buying a 15-foot fiberglass canoe. And it was absolute misery just trying to get it on and off the truck or trying to get it into these spots. Because some of these areas, you have to walk a couple hundred yards with the canoe on your head trying to get back into them. So last year or 2 years ago, I bought an Old Town 119 Solo. So it's a little 11-footer that weighs 42 pounds or 45 pounds, something like that. So that makes it much, much easier. The downside to a smaller canoe is that it drafts more, so you can't get in to some of these really, really shallow areas. And when you put a deer in it, you really don't have a whole lot of room with you.
Gotcha. Okay. So what are the, I've never had this conversation before, by the way. So what are the benefits of a longer canoe versus a shorter canoe?
Or a longer canoe is just going to give you, it just gives you more room, more opportunity to have more weight with you. But if you're trying to get into these smaller creeks or smaller channels, like that long canoe is just arduous to try and move around and deal with. So having that small canoe, you can get up and over logs with it. If they're, you know, an inch or two under the water, if you get a little speed underneath you, you can try and hop over some stuff. And just the weight wise, if you got a long walk or a long drag between creek channels or different parts of a marsh, it's just so much easier with that small canoe to do that.
Gotcha. Out of curiosity, I've heard a lot of guys talk about kayaking in. Why a canoe over a kayak?
Just the amount of space that you get. We have a couple of kayaks at home, and I had done that originally in some of these spots. Luckily, I never shot anything with a kayak because there's no room. You're sitting inside of that kayak. Like, I don't know if you would try and hook a rope to the deer and drag it behind you down the river with the kayak. But that wouldn't work for me.
Gotcha. Okay. So you like the shorter canoe, for easy, like maneuvering from your truck to the waterway. What's the downside then of having a shorter canoe that, other than less space?
I don't think there's not really a whole lot of downside to it other than just the weight factor starts to play more of a role in a small canoe because, you know, the one that I have right now, I think it's only rated for about 350 pounds. Mm-hmm. And you put, you know, a 220 pound guy and 30 pounds worth of gear in there. Well, you're starting to run out of room when you try and put an actual, you know, decent sized buck in that canoe then.
Yeah. And so I know you've put deer in your canoe and to get them out, right?
Yeah.
With your gear and with you, you're exceeding that weight limit of 300 some pounds. Have you ever been put in a position to where that weight has started taking in water?
I haven't got to the taking in water part. I've run into issues where you start to bottom the canoe out in shallower stretches.
Gotcha.
And I did have one a number of years ago where there was road access and water access. I took the water access in, shot a buck, canoed back to my truck, drove around to the other side of the property, and then drug the deer up the hill and put it in my truck that way.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. And so what about, My question is, what about current, like high water versus low water? And then like weight, obviously if the more weight in the canoe, the deeper it goes, you mentioned bottoming out, but what about like the speed of the water and how that affects a longer versus a shorter canoe?
The shorter canoe doesn't, the bow of that canoe doesn't get pushed around as much with a shorter canoe. You know, the longer it is, the harder it's going to be to steer. So one, current is an issue, but two, wind is an issue when you start getting into those really long canoes.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that, it's just harder to navigate, like take turns and stay on course at that point?
Yep. But the one nice thing, if you do have a big canoe, is you can also bring a buddy with you to help.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. And the short canoe, you're not throwing your homeboy in there to come help track or drag or paddle out. Like, it's just not an option then.
Right. Okay. So I'm assuming if you're taking water access, in some of these swampy areas, you're not necessarily wearing like hiking boots per se. Talk to me a little bit about maybe rubber boots or waders and why you choose and when you choose those.
Yeah, ideally, if you're taking the canoe in, you can try and get to some drier areas and then you can just use, you know, your typical rubber boots or, you know, Alpha Burleys or whatever you choose.
Yeah.
That's the ideal scenario. Most of the time I'm in hip boots if I'm in the canoe, just makes life a little bit easier. You don't need to think about it quite as much. And then I don't need to worry about having wet feet all day in the stand. Yeah. If I'm not bringing the canoe, then generally I'm going to be in chest waders for the entire day, which also is not fun.
Yeah. What does, what's the depth of the water? Like when you're walking in on one of your access routes, what is the max depth that you've encountered?
There's a few spots where it's, you know, full waist deep water that you're trying to walk through. And that's when you have to have those chest waders with you.
Yes. And so then how do you do that? How do you have a backpack on? How do you have, I don't know if you're carrying a saddle or a stick, like a tree stand with you and a pack and keeping all of that dry?
Yeah. I mean, that's why I one stick and saddle hunt. It's because you can get everything just into that backpack. You can cinch it up really tight, put it high on your waist. And try and keep everything dry. You know, there's certainly days where you get in there and the bottom of your pack is wet, but that's still better than trying to get a full tree stand in there or something like that.
Yeah. What rubber boots do you run? What hip boots do you run? What waders do you run?
Generally, my rubber boots are just going to be Alpha Burleys. Mm-hmm. I've liked those. I like the fit on them. I actually run super cheap hip boots. I think they're Frog Togs or something like that you buy at, you know, Fleet Farm. They're like $50 a pair.
Yeah.
They last a couple of years, but the downside to those is it's just a straight rubber boot and you sweat to death in them.
Yeah.
Trying to walk through these areas. So, I mean, you're quote unquote dry, but you're also soaking wet normally by the time you get in.
Yeah.
And then I run a pair of Sims breathable chest waders. And then just felt sole boots when I'm running that, which is nice. It keeps you a little bit drier, but then you're also dealing with felt sole boots, and they make climbing trees a lot harder.
Yeah. Is that because the sole is flexible and there's no rigidity to it?
The sole's flexible. It doesn't have any true grip to it. You know, the boots that I'm running right now are made for walking over rocks and you know, wet stuff like that. It's not ideal, and the boots are oversized because they're going over waders. So you've just got these giant clunky boots on, and you're trying to climb these trees, and you hit yourself in the face a few times going up the tree, and it's super fun. I love what I do.
Yeah, you're really convincing.
Yeah, you're like, man, Aaron, this sounds great. I'm gonna start doing all this stuff immediately.
Yeah, exactly. I think I'm gonna go lease some land today. Okay, so, and then you're telling me that there's a lot of days where you don't bring another pair of boots to change into. You're hunting in your hip waders or hip boots the entire hunt.
Correct. And that's just, again, because a lot of these accesses are difficult to get into, where an extra 3 or 4 pounds on my back just doesn't sound that much fun. I mean, last year going in for a rifle hunt, when I got to my tree, my Garmin watch dinged, and I'm like, what is going on here? And it said, workout recorded elliptical 57 minutes. And I'm like, oh God.
that's the amount of, well, that's crazy. That just kind of lets everybody know the amount of energy you're spending to get back into some of these spots, right? So what does wearing hip waders in cold weather do, especially when you're sitting all day long and not moving? You go from sweating your balls off, I'm guessing, to getting up in a saddle and then in hip waders and then stop moving. As we all know, as hunters, you do that and you don't have the right gear, then you start to get cold really quickly. How do you stay warm in hip waders?
I mean, your feet are going to be cold. That's just something that you just have to accept at that point. I'll just throw puffies on over the top of everything once I get up in the tree or before I get up, and try and keep at least my legs warm. But I mean, my feet are frozen the entire time.
Yeah. That doesn't sound like fun.
It's not. Okay. I don't do this because it's the fun, comfortable way of doing things.
Yeah. Okay. So then for some reason, when I think of a guy in hip waders in a tree, I don't think that's quiet. It doesn't sound like it's quiet. Is it?
The hip boots, the rubber ones are pretty quiet. Those ones aren't bad. You start running into issues once you get to a breathable, like, chest weight or like the Sims that I run. Mm-hmm. They make plenty of noise when you move. And I mean, you need to understand that prior to getting in the tree or, figuring out exactly how you're positioning your saddle, because you aren't going to be able to move the way that you're used to, mm-hmm. especially in cold weather. If your boots are soaked, your waders are soaked, and if it's below freezing, you're going to start running into issues with them freezing up and making just an insane amount of noise.
Like, all right, guys, you know me, and I love eating wild game, but I don't eat wild game every single night. Every once in a while, I'll reach for a side of beef, and that's why I trust Omaha Steaks. Because Omaha Steaks are sent directly to my door, I can keep my freezer stocked without having to go to the grocery store. It's honestly like having a trusted butcher and gourmet food shop right at your house. Last week, I pulled out their pure ground ribeye burgers for a quick grill session. The flavor and marbling was unreal, rich, juicy, and miles ahead of any average grocery store meat. Try the Burger Perfection Flight at omahasteaks.com today. That's 20 premium steak burgers for just $79.99. Plus, get $35 off with promo code BEEF. That's omahasteaks.com, promo code BEEF for $35 off at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. Like ice cracking, or like, I'm thinking that when two rubber, wader legs rub together, it makes a potential squeaking noise. Does that happen at all? Yeah.
Yeah, both. Yeah. And on top of it, if you have felt sole boots on that freeze, they also get very, very slippery once they start to freeze.
Gotcha.
So you just try to not die the whole time.
Gotcha. Dude, you're just making this sound so exciting. So that's a little bit of the clothes. Are you then trying to mitigate some of that with like a merino wool base layer or a really good base layer then?
Yeah. Always running merino. Generally I'll do like the zip off merino bottoms. Mm-hmm. So I'll go in just in pants and hip boots, and then I'll, drop the hip boots down, drop the pants down, zip on some merinos before I climb up. Are you a saddle guy or do you hunt out of a hang on?
Yeah, I do both, like a hang on or a saddle. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause, once you get up in the tree, there is no more adjusting, putting something on, taking something off.
Right.
It is doable with puffies to be able to, zip them up over the top of your saddle.
Yeah.
So generally that's what I try and do. But yeah, trying to just run merinos once I get to my stand, basically change. But like I said, I don't bring extra boots. I probably should. It's just I don't have room in my pack.
Yeah. 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 So you have to be ultra efficient with all of your gear. Is what it sounds like. Okay. And then are you then also bringing a shell in? Like you mentioned a puffy. Are you just using that puffy on the outside, or are you taking your coat off in cooler temps, putting the puffy on, and then putting your shell back over top of that?
Normally I don't bring a shell, unless it's raining or misty or something like that, then I'll bring some sort of a wind block layer. But generally I'm just trying to go as light as possible. So just running, ultralight puffies, and then being cold is just part of the game.
Yeah. What puffy are you using, out of curiosity?
I have, they're the Kuyu Pros, I want to say, something like that. So, I mean, they're warm. They're not perfect for bow hunting in any way, shape, or form. They kind of sound like a bag of chips when you try and put them on in the morning, because
especially
they're so
if it's cold. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Where they're just insanely noisy. In that case, then I'll put a shell over the top of it just to try and calm that noise factor down a little bit.
Yeah. I'm going to tell you something, man. I bought an Eddie Bauer. There's an Eddie Bauer store in the mall, and Eddie Bauer was running a sale, and the regular price of this puffy jacket was $200. And this was several years ago, and it was on sale for like $80. And so I bought it, and I have used this puffy jacket. I wear it around, back and forth throughout my regular day when it's cold. I wear it in the timber. It's my insulation layer essentially, right? And then I put a shell over top of it because it's navy blue. And dude, that thing has performed for me so well to the point where I'm just like, you know, like I'm that guy who if it works for me, I stick with it. And so if that thing ever tears or I start to like it starts to deteriorate, which it hasn't in the last like 7+ years, I'm going to go to Eddie Bauer and try to find that same exact jacket again.
Yeah. Yeah. When it works, it works.
It works. Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, growing up, you know, all of us, you know, we had the super heavy clothes and stuff that. Now with Puffy's coming out and getting better and better, like it's hard to beat them, especially for just size and weight ratios. Yeah. You know, you can bring all that insulation in with you and it doesn't take up your entire pack or add 9 pounds in your backpack every time you want to try and stay warm.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will say this, like I can remember when I was a kid, there was no such thing as merino. There was no such thing as wool in general. I mean, there were guys wearing it, but I was wearing like Walmart long johns with a pair of jeans over top of it over top of a pair of overalls. And so that was my insulation layer. It was like cotton and denim, two things that like do not hold heat at all, right? So it was difficult. And then like in the really cold temps, I can remember days where I was wearing like 3 hooded sweatshirts and trying to draw a bow back I looked like the kid from the Christmas Story whose mom sent him out all like, you know, with too much clothes, man. So yeah, outside of that, any other clothing like for your unique scenario that you rely on?
Not really. I mean, I feel like it's pretty basic. You know, you have to have the right footwear to be able to access these pieces. But yeah, other than that, it's just merinos and puffies just to try and get as much warmth with as few layers as possible.
Yeah. With you going back that far and the difficulty of the access route in general, are you an all day hunter then at that point?
In those spots, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going into those spots unless my cameras are showing me that there's a reason to be there. You know, if I have a couple of decent bucks that are daylighting, it's like, well, I'm going to get in there in the morning. That's my easiest time to access these pieces in the first place.
Yep.
And yeah, get back there. Generally, I'm, you know, just running like a merino t-shirt in the morning. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter if it's 10 degrees outside. You know, just running that in, take that shirt off when I get to the stand, throw on something dry, and then start climbing.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. And that's a perfect transition to talk to me about your getting in the tree setup now. So you're out of the canoe, you've walked to the tree that you're getting ready to get in. And so talk to me about your tree stand / saddle setup, whatever that is.
Yeah. So I've gone through a handful of different setups now. When I first started saddle hunting, I was running the Lone Wolf 3-step sticks. You know, they're like 30 inches long and like 2.5 pounds a piece.
Dude, I love those. I love those. And I'm that guy who like, and I told you about when I'm good at it. And I'm sorry to interrupt, but that's what I bought at a garage sale several years ago. Like, my first mobile setup was a Lone Wolf tree assault and one of the originals. I think I still have it in a tree with 4 sticks like that. And when I tell you that it was like I had used it so much over the course of my life, I was setting that up in 5 minutes, just like boom, choop, you know, like I found the method for all of that to work. And is it like what at the time packing all of that in was at the time it was the best option. You know what I mean? And so even though some would consider it heavy, it was mobile, and mobile is what I wanted. And so I had one set of those, and that is what made everything in my life better as far as hunting was concerned.
Yeah. And I mean, that's the exact setup that I still run. If my wife hunts with me, that's what I'm setting up for her, is going in with that. But now, I mean, I don't make her go into the swamps that I hunt at this point. She tried to go back 3 gun seasons ago with me into one of these swamps. And she actually ended up tearing her ACL about a mile in.
Oh shit.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, 4 a.m. opening morning. And yeah, she got tangled up in some cedar roots and fell weird and yeah, full tear on her ACL. But my wife being who she is, just told me, hey, just set up the tree stand at the bottom of this tree, lift me in. And she sat there 9 hours, I want to say, that day.
What, number one, what a tough broad. You know what I mean? Number two, yeah. did she ever forgive you for that? Like, she was going back there because of you, right? She wasn't doing that shit by herself. And then she tears her ACL, right? Like, did she like hold it over your head for several years?
No, she was a good sport with it. She knew it was a spot that I really wanted to get into. I mean, I saw some decent deer that day. I didn't shoot any. Cause again, being in these swamps, like, it's gotta be kind of a slammer for you to want to deal with. But yeah, after 8 or 9 hours, she finally texts me. She's like, hey, we should leave.
Yeah.
Like, all right. I mean, I packed my stuff up, went, got her stand, pulled everything out. And I mean, it was, I want to say, about 2.5 hours for us to walk her out after that. And then, had full reconstructive surgery about 6 months later on that.
Damn, dude. I've been through 2 ACL replacements, so I know exactly what that feels like. Not fun. Well,
yeah. So
she's tough.
Yep, she's tough. And luckily I don't have to deal with that stand a whole lot now. but no, my setup at this point, so I run a Buzzard Roost saddle. So it's a 2-piece saddle. It's a little bit more comfortable for those super long sits.
Yeah. What was the name of the brand?
It's a Buzzard Roost.
Buzzard Roost.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So you're able to move that top section of your saddle up pretty high on your back. So it gives you a little bit more support that way. Okay. I run that, and I run a Shikar 1-stick.
Okay. That's interesting. Explain that, because talk to me a little bit about what, just go into the details about what a 1-stick is for those who don't know.
Yeah. So the 1-stick is, I mean, it's basically just a climbing method where rather than bringing 3, 4, 5 sticks in, you're hooking a single stick with a 3-step aider on the bottom of it. Mm-hmm. You know, you go as high as you can in the tree with that, climb up, you attach your saddle, you attach your tether rope, then you hang on the side of the tree, reach down, pull that stick off, put it back up above your head, climb back up, and you just repeat that until you get to whatever height you want to be at.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, that 1-stick that I run, I think it's 14 ounces.
Okay.
So it's just ultra, ultra light. I just run an Amsteel daisy chain on it. Mm-hmm. So there's no screwing around at that point. You just squirrel up the tree. But you need a relatively straight tree to get up with them, because you are hanging off the side. And, you know, if it's not straight, then you just end up, you know, lassoing around the tree or swinging around the tree every time, which makes it pretty tough. And then if I'm sitting an all day sit, I'll bring just a tethered predator platform, just so I have something where I can stand on once in a while. Cause that small stick just has I think it's a 4-inch by 12-inch angled platform on the top of it.
Okay.
So it's not the most comfortable thing to stand on, but you know, if you're going for a 4, 5, 6 hour sit, it's not that bad to sit on that.
Gotcha.
But anything longer than that, you're going to want some form of platform with you.
Right. And with 1-sticking, is there aiders that go below it as well?
Yep. So I run a 3-step aider underneath that.
A 3-step aider. And then, so how do you, I guess I need to probably go watch a video of how that works, because once you get that set, how do you move the whole system up without being without stepping on it.
So you put your tether up in the tree, you cock it off to the side a little bit, then you just basically hang in your saddle on the tree, reach down, pluck your stick off, and then reset.
Okay. So you're essentially just hanging off the, okay. So there's 2 points of contact essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha.
So yeah. Okay. You just hang off the side of the tree, pull that stick off, put it back up above your head, get your foot on the aider, climb back up, move your tether up the tree as you go.
Okay. Okay. Now it starts to make sense. Okay. I gotcha. And how long did it take for you to be comfortable with that method?
Couple of days, honestly. Yeah. You know, if you're already used to hanging sticks and having those points of contact, you know, if you're using a lineman's belt like you mm-hmm. probably should be when you're hanging stuff, you're already used to, you know, putting your confidence in that system and in those ropes. And really the only difference is, you know, rather than a lineman's belt, you just always have that tether on.
Yep. Okay.
But
gotcha.
Getting out of the tree has always, you know, that is what weirds people out the most, because you're rappelling out of the tree at the end of your sit then.
Right.
So right. You just take that stick off, rappel down. I use a Mad Rock rappel system. So it
is it works. Hand? Like it's hand. So like you squeeze it to release the tension, or you let go and it tightens up or something like that.
Yeah, so there's just a small lever on it, and you pull the lever out, and that starts to release the rope. Gotcha. And as you get better with it, you're able to get up and down pretty quick with that. Gotcha. And then you do have to retrieve your rope out of the tree. So I use just an Amsteel pull rope to then pull my rope out of the tree once I get down.
Gotcha. Okay, so I'm watching a video of that right now. Like, what happens if you drop your stick?
Then you rappel out of the tree and grab your stick and go back up.
Okay. That's crazy, because I'm watching the video right now and the guy just has his tether on. So mm-hmm. you're saying that the tether itself has to be long enough for you to come out of the tree with it, right?
Yep. Yep. Okay. So I run a 40-foot climbing rope.
Okay. All right. That makes more. Now I'm understanding. Okay, now I'm understanding it. All right, I'm a dumbass. I've never done it before. But I can see how somebody, let me just be honest with me. How good a shape are you in?
I mean, I did a half marathon in April.
Okay, so this isn't a method for like a weekend warrior hoagie eating guy. Like, I don't know, like you got to be in somewhat good shape to be bending and pull, like using your feet to pull the stick up and rappelling down. Like, this isn't for like big dudes, right?
Probably not. I mean, there's one video online, the first one that I think I watched, like the dude's not skinny track running type of guy. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, he's a relatively big fella.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, you need to have that mobility to be able to do something like that rather than just putting, you know, your normal sticks on.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. Yeah. All right. So you're running the Buzzard Roost saddle. You're doing the one stick method. You got some you got a daisy chain up there as well. What does the rest of your, like, do you have any screw in steps? Do you just hang stuff off the daisy chain? What's that look like as far as your accessories once you're in the tree, your bow holder, stuff like that?
Yeah, so generally I'm just running like a daisy chain. Tethered has one, I can't remember what it's called, that just hooks to the tree, and I've got a couple of clips on there. So one for my bow, hang my backpack off the other side. You know, in order to get all this stuff in, I don't like wearing my saddle in mm-hmm. anywhere, so I like putting that in a pack. So I'm running a Stone Glacier 5900 just to keep all of my stuff relatively organized and be able to get in and out of there.
Gotcha.
But yeah, just hang the backpack on the right side, hang my bow on the left. I'm a right-handed shooter, so that works for me the best. And like I said, it's nice to have that secondary platform, just so that you can get around the tree a little bit better.
Yeah. Okay. How difficult is that to do in the dark?
Now, not hard.
Yeah.
When I first started, it was a little more unnerving. Mm-hmm. But, you know, like you said, with, you know, the lone wolves back in the day, like you get to a point where, I mean, you just fly up the tree.
Right.
And I mean, I can go from ground level to 20 feet up in, yeah, 4 minutes probably.
Yeah. Okay. And getting down is the easy part, right? So then, like, when you are at the bottom of the tree and the rope is still up, what do you have to do? Just basically shake it till it falls back down?
So you attach like your pull rope for your bow.
Mm-hmm.
So you attach that to the carabiner that your tether is on, and you can pull that at an angle, and that will then drop that rope down for you.
Like it releases it. 95%
of the time.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right, cool.
Yeah, above 5% of the time you go to pull that and it gets caught somewhere weird, and then you have to reclimb the tree in the dark after you've sat for 12 hours and you're really, really, really mad about it.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
Yeah, it happens about once a year for me where I'll have to reclimb the tree. And I mean, it's easy to climb when your tether is a couple of feet long, but when your rope is up 25 feet and you're trying to climb, like you're swinging around and like, yeah. It's not fun. You're not going to get necessarily hurt because you're tied into the tree, but you're going to swing around the tree. You're going to hit yourself in the face a couple of times. So yeah, you do everything you can to not have to reclimb that tree.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. What else? What other? So the access we've covered, the mobility we've covered. What other gear specific to the way you hunt do you use? That maybe I wouldn't, just hunting like a farm country.
I think that the most important thing that I ever bring with me is a thermocell.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense.
Yeah, you're hunting water all the time. Like the bugs can get really, really, really bad back there. So you need to have something to just make that sit a little bit more doable.
Yeah. How often are you going? Like you mentioned that you put trail cameras up.
Mm-hmm.
Back in there. And that kind of tells you when you need to, you know, cell cam technology is kind of telling you when you need to go in there. How often are you going in there early season when the bugs are bad?
Never.
Never. Okay.
Nope. I put my cameras up in generally March every year.
Gotcha.
I run them year round. The cameras I'm running have really good battery life. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I go in there and right now I get about 9,000 pictures a day of grass swinging around because, you know, in these swampy areas, there's so much swamp grass that grows up. But generally by end of August, that grass starts to lay down again and they start to actually take pictures of deer.
So do you have solar panels on these?
No. So I'm just running lithium batteries.
Lithium batteries. And okay, so wait, what cameras are you using?
So they actually don't make them anymore. So they're the Covert WC30s.
Okay.
They take okay pictures.
Yep.
They're kind of expensive to run. You know, it's $10 per camera per month.
Yep.
But I mean, they last 16 months, I think, is
on a full set of batteries.
Yeah.
And how many pictures are they sending a day?
I mean, 10 to 30 pictures a day generally.
Okay. All right. And so those have worked for you that long with that old of a camera is Covert still a camera company?
I don't honestly know if they're even making any cameras anymore. They discontinued these ones, I want to say 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I have 10 of them, I think, right now.
Yeah.
Once those go out, I honestly have no idea what I'm going to do. Because if I have cameras that don't run for, at least 8 months, that's going to cause a little bit more of an issue for me.
Right. Cause then you have to go in there all the time, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You have to go in there and you have to go in there when it's not frozen then.
Exactly.
You know, the ideal time in any of these swamps that I hunt is after the snow comes off, but before everything starts to really unthaw, and I can just scoot my way back there and, you know, trying to hunt these spots or trying to scout these spots in the summer. It's horrifying.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I'm not seeing, like, I clicked on the covert cameras and it takes me to, wait, Faradine must have bought them.
Mm-hmm.
And so a little bit of a rebrand there. Looks like they have, okay. All right. Okay, so then the trail cameras are telling you when to kind of pop in as far as the hunting is concerned, right? So you're not hunting early season very often.
Not often. I mean, I've had a few instances where you get lucky enough and you can get these cameras into a buck bedding area, yeah, without blowing it out, especially when you're never having to go in.
Mm-hmm.
But I've only had that a few times where it's made sense to really hit these areas in early season. Generally, I'm waiting until, yeah, end of October before I start worrying about these spots.
Gotcha. And so at that point, the thermocell is only for those rare instances, because once it freezes, the bugs aren't an issue anymore.
Yeah, yeah. At that point, it doesn't matter nearly as much.
Gotcha. Gotcha. I will say this, that I have never hunted with a thermocell ever in my entire life. I've just kind of toughed it out if it was bad. However, this last, not this year, but last year, I went to South Dakota and the mosquitoes were so bad that I went back into town and bought a thermocell, everything I needed for a thermocell. And it didn't like prevent it, but it slowed it down a little bit. Man, I ran that thing the entire time. It was on all the time. Like when I was out there, the mosquitoes were so bad this year. It was nuts.
Yeah. I mean, we get it where, you know, it's the second that you stop at the bottom of your tree, you're turning that thermocell on because, I mean, you're just getting absolutely hammered,
yeah,
by mosquitoes. And it's like, I can deal with being cold. I can deal with being wet, but man, just something about just constantly getting bit, just, yeah, it doesn't work for me. I'm just going to be swinging around in the tree and nothing's coming by me when you're doing that.
Exactly. Exactly. Anything else as far as gear is concerned for these wetter marsh type environments?
Throw away your canoe paddle and get a kayak paddle.
And why is that make a difference?
Just being able, kayak paddles just seem like they work better in this scenario, you know, rather than going one side, then shifting your weight to the other, then shifting your weight to the other to use a canoe paddle. It just doesn't work nearly as well. And having that long paddle, if you need to push yourself through areas, okay, or, you know, stick it into the cattails and try and pull yourself into a landing area, it just makes life so much easier.
Yeah. Yeah. How often are you having to go in and like create your own little path through the grass? Like you ram your canoe into the grass and then you get out and you have to basically mash your own trail, or are you using trails that are already there from wildlife or waterways?
I try and use something that's there from wildlife. Yeah. I've got a few spots where, you know, over the years you mash an area down good enough that your trail kind of stays throughout the year.
Gotcha.
So, you know, you're really only dealing with that the first time you get into a spot. But there's a few bogs that I hunt where there is only one access point, so you have to mash your canoe through it. I'm guessing you don't have bogs in Iowa that you would ever deal with.
When you say bog, you just think, I think of an area that necessarily isn't standing water, but is always wet and soft, and you sink down in it when you walk.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, like by us, you know, you can get into some of these pieces where there'll be a lake and a bog that you can paddle across. But once you get to the edge, like that ground that you see is floating.
Oh, yeah. There'll
be 8-10 feet of water underneath that. So you need to try and find something, you know, an actual tree or something to land next to where you can actually get up onto it. Because if you fall through a bog, you're going to die.
Yeah, I can't wait until they find you in 10,000 years. Something happens where you go underneath of a bog. Like, you know, every once in a while out in the UK, they'll be like, this sheep farmer fell through a bog and now we found him 10,000 years later. And it's like they're like studying you.
Yeah, it's always in the back of your head. Like I told my wife I was just going for an afternoon hunt. Yeah. And
Yeah, exactly. 10,000 years later, you show up. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Man, I'll tell, like, that would be kind of cool. Cause I've found arrowheads before while I'm hunting or doing like hanging trail cameras or something like that. And I thought it would be, you know, hilarious if they found me, or like, what happens if there's another hunter in a couple thousand years that finds my arrow that I had flung, you know, and hit a deer, but never found it, right? Never found the arrow after it, or killed a deer, and they find my broadhead and they find my arrow and they're just like, oh, look at this. This is 1,000 years old. So I don't know.
Yeah, look at this old primitive stuff that they used to hunt
exactly.
with, you know, carbon arrows and steel broadheads.
Exactly. That would be crazy. That'd be crazy. What else? Is there anything else?
I think that pretty much covers it. You know, like I said, it's just using that water access in so many instances just makes you so much quieter. Yeah. That you, this isn't something that I do because there isn't another access to a lot of these pieces. It's just, it makes the most sense.
Yeah.
You know, I think Remy always says that you go the right way, not the easy way. Mm-hmm. And that just rings true in a lot of this. Cause right. It's like, even in the spots where, you know, I'm wearing chest waders to get through some of this area, it's like, I could go a different route and just wear rubber boots, mm-hmm. but then you end up walking through bedding cover and you end up walking close to these ag fields that the deer are in. It's just like, I'd rather be silent mm-hmm. than be comfortable.
Right. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. And what you've done is you've curated your gear for this method of coming. And I'm sure you could walk from the road or the parking lot in and stomp all over the public to get to these spots. But what that does is it blows the deer out and you're pushing deer further away from you. So you've found a method that gets you probably more success, not only from just seeing and shooting deer, but from the, I don't know, from seeing the right deer, right? The bigger, higher age class, older caliber, bigger antlered deer.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, even like walking down creeks, like you'll walk 30 yards past does that are feeding mm-hmm. and they don't see you, they don't hear you, they don't smell you because you're in that water access. Yep. You would never be able to do that walking through CRP or walking through a creek bottom,
no.
You know, on the edge.
No. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. All right. Well, great conversation. I think this has been very insightful, especially. Oh, here's my last question I wanted to ask you. Are you bringing in food or snacks or water with you? Because when you do this, you're sitting there all day.
Yep. You always have to have at least a handful of snacks.
What's your go-to snack?
You know, I'm a big fan of making bagel sandwiches in the morning. The only reason that I like bagels is because they don't get smashed down in your pack like a normal sandwich does.
Gotcha. So the bread
it always kind of looks the same.
Yeah. So there's some durability with the bagel is what you're saying.
Yep. The bagel, it'll hold its shape. You're not, you know, it's not smushed by the time you get back. And
yeah.
Yeah. You know, I do lunch meat with deer roast a lot, so I'll do pastrami or corned venison, so I'll make a pastrami bagel in the morning, and like that'll be my midday reward for staying awake until noon.
Yeah, exactly. My friend Aaron, appreciate your time once again. Thank you very much. Also, I suggest to those who are listening to go listen to the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast that I did with him about the actual strategy and the terrain that he goes through throughout the course of his hunting season. That's very insightful as well. Outside of that, if you guys could go to Spotify or Apple Podcasts, wherever you download the Hunting Gear podcast, tell your friends about it, like, subscribe, leave comments, all that stuff. So Aaron, again, thank you for your time. To all of you, thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.